It was used as a currency. It was used to anoint kings as a means of war for, you know, lubricating horse saddles and weaponry.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Olive oil, it's as old as civilization. To quote Mort Rosenblum, author of Olives, The Life and Lore of a Noble Fruit, a book that was reliably found on my father's coffee table, olives have permeated every Mediterranean culture from prehistory to last week. And since the 18th century, that includes the Mediterranean culture of California. This week, I'm speaking with Philip Asquith, Master Miller of Ojai Olive Oil, also my brother. I had the pleasure of seeing him in person in August when my kids and I visited at the farm he inherited from my father, whom we both miss terribly. This one's for you, Dad. The farm is tucked into the foothills of the Ojai Valley, that's O-J-A-I, at the edge of the Sespe Wilderness, where coyotes, bobcats, and bear are common, where you see quail families skirting underfoot the native oaks, and where the remaining California condors live. In 1997, my dad purchased this oddly shaped piece of land, having made note of the more than 100-year-old olive grove on it. He later traveled to Italy to purchase a press and learn how to make olive oil, and started the business that my brother runs today. I know more than your average customer about olive oil, but still, I learned a lot talking to my brother, and I think you'll find it interesting too. How to shop for a good bottle of olive oil, for example, which is more complicated than you might think, and why I'm only going to let my kids use lip balm made from olive oil in the future. We recorded the interview outdoors in the grove. In the beginning, you'll hear us walking down the hill from Philip's house towards the olive barn where the press is located. When I was editing this episode, I didn't fuss too much about the ambient noise. I thought you might enjoy the feel of being there. Also, I posted some pictures on my website, in-the-weeds.net, to help you imagine being there. All right, let's get started. On our walk, we started talking about the olive trees themselves, beginning with the old grove. So tell me, okay, so the ones they had were Spanish olives. Were they all the same kind?
All the same. So every one of the old sort of heritage grove trees are a variety called Lechon de Sevilla, comes from the south of Spain, and produces a very strong, very peppery, very robust olive oil.
Yeah.
And specifically makes olive oil. They don't make very good eating olives. So we were able to tell that whoever planted them clearly had the intention of making olive oil, not of producing eating olives.
So tell me what the other varieties of olives that you grow now are.
So the main grove here to the right is all columella trees, which are a French variety, south of France, makes a very sweet, buttery, fruity oil. The bulk of the groves are Italian varieties, Licino, Pendolino, Frantoio, and Morino, and some Nocciolara del Belice, which is Sicilian. The rest are Tuscan.
Okay.
And those produce pretty characteristic Italian olive oils, grassy, peppery, but kind of middle of the road. So we've ultimately broken it down into our French olives, our Italian olives, and our Spanish olives.
And do you find that your customers tend to gravitate towards a particular variety of oil? Should we sit at a table for a little bit? And then we can walk some more.
Different people tend to prefer different ones. Most Americans haven't had fresh olive oil ever, so they tend to prefer the mildest, the Provençal, which is our columella, mostly some Picholine. Sometimes we add the Nocciolara del Belice in there because it's very mild as well. And there's another grove we harvest that has a lot of a French variety called Cailloutier, which is wonderful. That's also an eating olive they use to make the salad niçoise.
That dark?
Yeah, kind of reddish, sometimes reddish. So all of those go into the Provençal olive oil, which is very mild, and that tends to be the most popular. And then people that are more experienced foodies or chefs or things like that always go for the Andalusian, the strongest one. They want the sharpest, the most bite, because that's what they associate with quality.
So this is an organic grove.
Yes.
What does that mean for olives? Like, how different is an organic grove from a conventional grove?
So with olives, that's pretty easy. There's really no reason to grow olives any other way than organically, because they don't really require much in the way of fertilizing, and they don't really have much in the way of pests. So it's not like you're fighting tons of bugs and things attacking your trees. There's one fruit fly that's very easy to control with little traps. It's much cheaper than spraying. And because they don't require much water, you're not dealing with a lot of weeds in sort of the undergrowth. So there's really no need for herbicides or pesticides or chemical fertilizers. Mm-hmm. So it begs one to ask the question, if somebody's making olive oil or growing olives not organically, you know, what are they using and why? And it's usually things like Roundup, just out of laziness. They don't want to bother pruning the weeds away and weed whacking, so they just spray Roundup all over the ground, which is awful. Or they're using strong chemical fertilizers trying to get a higher yield, which doesn't really work that well and isn't necessary. Plus, olives are particularly conducive, olive oil is particularly conducive to absorbing any toxins. Because it's a very concentrated food, you know, you've got a whole year's worth of light and water and food mm-hmm. going into the crop of olives. And then all those nutrients get concentrated even more into the olive oil, which is an especially good carrier. It's one of the reasons it's used for cosmetics and supplements. So if you're using toxic chemicals to grow it, those chemicals are going to get concentrated in the olive oil.
I hadn't thought about that, but I suppose that makes sense. Anything that's a fat, right, would probably do that.
Yeah, absorbs things very well. So it's best to grow them organically, for mm-hmm. sure, so, and it's much easier.
And as a consumer, better
to... Yeah, consumer, you only really want organic olive oil.
So farmers always have certain woes. What are the things that you worry about as an olive farmer?
The biggest is that olives are traditionally a cyclical crop. So you get good years and bad years. And historically, that's been a consistent pattern with not huge swings, but, you know, decent noticeable swings from one year to the next. Lately, though, over the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years, those swings have become much more dramatic to a point now where a lot of groves have zero fruit in the off year and then a lot of fruit in the good year. And that makes it very difficult as a business to maintain a consistent supply because most groves in a region sync up at the same time. So, for example, this year, everybody's having a huge year.
Does that have to do with pollination or...?
It has to do with the natural cyclical nature of fruits and nuts, which are particularly strong.
Oh, like mast years? Is it equivalent to like a mast year for an oak tree or something like that?
Not similar, but it's every other year.
It's
literally
so
one year
consistent.
On, one year off.
Okay.
And most fruits and nuts have some degree of cyclical mm-hmm. productivity. With olives, it's fairly dramatic. And because of the sort of weather and climate being the way it has lately, and just everything being a little bit more unpredictable, the swings have become very huge to a point where almost all of California had no olives 2 years ago. So producers all over the place were having to buy olives and olive oil from abroad just to maintain their supply, which is tricky when you're trying to have a brand based on local olive oil or California olive oil.
Right.
So that's our biggest challenge, but we've found ways to deal with that, mostly by working with, at this point, probably about 15 other groves in the region. And fortunately, enough of those groves have a good year in any given season that we can get enough olives.
And you have relationships with those farmers, so you know how they're growing them. And
in most cases, either I planted those trees for them or Dad planted those trees for them, in which case we helped them pick the varieties with an understanding that if they grew them organically and responsibly, we would take the harvest at the end of each year.
So obviously one of your selling points to your customers is that olive oil is healthy. Can you give me the pitch on that? Like what's the,
sure.
what's the, you probably know way more about why that's the case than I do.
Yes. Well, it is definitely healthy. It's one of the superfoods. Part of that is just because it's packed full of polyphenols and antioxidants and what they call the organoleptic compounds, which is a really fun word.
Okay, what is that?
It's just a long and complicated word for saying it has lots of healthy green things.
Mm.
It's, you know, it's logical. It's like chlorophyll or, you know, wheatgrass or a fresh green cold-pressed juice. You know, it's the healthy stuff in nature that you know is good for you.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much every vegetable and plant has something good for you.
Some kind of pigment or some kind of, yeah.
And olive oil just happens to be very concentrated in those health benefits. Plus, because it's an oil, because it's a fat, it's very well absorbed by the body, and it provides a key role. It's important to have some fats in your diet, and of all of them, olive oil is probably the healthiest. It's also the most compatible with the chemistry of the human body. Nobody really has allergies or bad reactions to olive oil. Again, why it's used in cosmetics a lot. One way to think of it is it's sort of like an oil change for your body.
Mm.
It's particularly good for the circulatory system. Helps keep everything running smoothly with your heart and all your arteries and veins. And it's also particularly good for the brain, for neural function. Helps prevent degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia, things like that. It just keeps your brain lubricated and running smoothly. And, of course, good for your joints as well. At this point, there are hundreds of studies about how it's good for, you know, everything from pregnancy to arthritis to, you know, all kinds of issues people have from young ages to old ages. It's just good for you.
Okay, I'm sold. I mean, I was already sold, but
sure.
Doubly so. So, but for my listeners and, you know, for a lot of people that I know, you know, in New York, for instance, people don't know a lot about what distinguishes one olive oil from another. And one of the things they don't know is that olive oil has a relatively short shelf life, right? So can you talk about that a little bit? What should a consumer look for to get a good quality olive oil that's going to have all these wonderful benefits?
Sure. The biggest issue consumers in the U.S. face is that more than 90% of our olive oil comes from abroad. And even though they make wonderful olive oil in Spain and Italy and other countries, they don't send the very best of it to us, in part because they can get a higher price for it locally. We pay less, and in part because it's damaged and declines in quality during the journey. Olive oil is a fragile food. It's meant to be kept at around 60 degrees, no oxygen, no sunlight, or else it oxidizes much more quickly. So when they ship that across the ocean and through trucks and warehouses and customs, they can't afford to keep it refrigerated. So it's going through wild temperature swings. You know, sitting in the back of a truck crossing the U.S. on a 100-degree day in the summer is enough to single-handedly seriously hurt the quality of that olive oil just in one day. And it can take months for it to do that journey. So as a result, pretty much everything coming into the U.S. from abroad is not in very good shape by the time it gets to the shelf.
And sometimes it's even fraudulent, right? There have been all these cases
and that's
where...
if it was good in the first place.
It's not even olive oil that's being sold.
Yeah, and it's kind of a problem that feeds itself. Because people here aren't used to good oil, it's very easy to pass off bad oil on them because they don't necessarily know the difference. So because it all kind of has a flat, bland taste when it gets here, you can mix in sort of other cheaper oils like canola oil, or you can take low-grade olive oils that are cheap to buy in bulk and just kind of blend them in, and it all just kind of has no taste, which makes it easy to trick people.
So if you're in the States, to begin with, you should be looking for domestic olive oil, which essentially means Californian olive oil.
Yes. So first and foremost, it should be as local as possible. And if you're in the U.S., local pretty much means California. There's some olive oil made at this point in Oregon and Arizona and Texas, and it's getting further and further spread out. But 95% of America's olive oil made in America comes from California.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the California olive oil standards are higher than anywhere else in the world. So to be called an extra virgin olive oil in California is much more strict than it is in Europe, even in Italy.
Hmm. So explain, because I think a lot of people don't know what that means. What is extra virgin olive oil? What distinguishes it from virgin, which is the next, right?
So there are a number of criteria you have to meet. One is it has to be what they call the first pressing, or the first milling of the fruit. It can't be where you take the leftover paste and run it through a second or third time, which happens a lot in big operations, and you get that cheaper oil. It has to be a cold extraction, a cold press. You can't add anything to the olives. It has to be just natural fruit. You can't add anything to the olive oil, of course, once it's made. But fundamentally, it's a measure of the acidity of the oil. And the acidity is a function of how much it's oxidized. So just like a banana goes brown or sort of fruit ages, olive oil will oxidize over time, mostly as a function of heat, light, and oxygen. And if that degree of oxidation causes the acidity to go above 1%, that's the cutoff for international extra virgin olive oil, is 1%. In California, it's 0.5%. So to be a California extra virgin olive oil, you have to be at 0.5% acidity or below. And what you'll find is between, say, 0.1% and 1%, which is all technically extra virgin by international standards, there's a huge range of quality in terms of taste, health value, shelf life, heat tolerance, that you could say it's equivalent to, you know, the difference between a $2 bottle and a $200 bottle of wine.
Wow. So you can tell, you can, if you're given some olive oil that's 1% acidity versus, you know, 0.2, 0.25, you can tell the difference.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. And shelf life.
The lower the acidity, the longer it'll last, the better it'll taste, the healthier it is, and the more heat it can tolerate in the kitchen.
Interesting. I didn't realize that. So, okay, so recapping. So you want organic olive oil from the States, assuming mm-hmm. you live in the States, and you want it to be extra virgin. You want to look at the date, right? That's one of the things you want to...
Yes. Because the harvest is cyclical, a lot of big operations will blend oils from their big year into the oil from their light year to sort of keep a consistent supply, and that significantly drops the quality. So you want to look at the date, and you want to look at where it was made, of course, and you want to see if it lists the acidity. If you had to look for one sort of data point on there, I would look for the acidity. And 9 out of 10 bottles won't list it, and that's because it's not a good number, even though every producer knows the acidity of every bottle they make. So if it lists the acidity on the bottle and it's below, say, 0.5% or 0.25%, then you're good to go. If it doesn't show it, it's because it's no good.
Okay. And shelf life, you don't want to buy anything, certainly, that's more than a year old, right? Is that, am I
definitely
right about that?
Definitely not more than a year old.
Okay.
Although shelf life is much more a function of how it's kept than how old it is.
Okay.
So a bottle could be a year and a half old, but if it's been kept in, you know, 57 degree cold room out of the light, you know, in an airtight container, it could be in better shape than one that's 3 months old that's been in a hot, bright room.
I see. Okay. Boy, there are really a lot of factors to consider.
Armed with Phil's recommendations, I recently went to shop for olive oil at Whole Foods. They have quite a range of choices. I noticed there was a decent amount of organic olive oils, a few in darkened bottles. After examining quite a few, I found only one that listed the acidity. I ended up buying an organic Mediterranean blend for cooking, the Whole Foods brand, and a, quote, special reserve extra virgin olive oil with 0.3% of acidity, but later discovered that it is a couple of years old. Whoops. Neither of them are in the territory of the olive oil I get from my family. Look, I'll just go ahead and say it. Go to ohaioliveoil.com, that's O-J-A-I again, and order some. It's freaking great stuff. All right, where were we?
So short of knowing the actual producer, it can be tricky, but like you said, there are a number of factors that you can look for to have sort of an educated guess.
Yes.
And then if they come visit you, of course, they can taste the olive oil. Maybe a little bit later we can do a little bit of tasting if it's not too busy there.
Absolutely. And that's really the best way to know is to find
taste
it locally.
Right.
Which, of course, is easier in the western U.S. than the east.
Yeah.
And also at farmers markets can be a great place to find it. Even if you're at a farmer's market in a state that doesn't produce olive oil, it's more likely to have a local olive oil, mm-hmm. or at least local-ish, than something from abroad.
Yes, in our case it's Greek. But at least, you know the person who's selling it knows who's producing it.
And yeah, so, there's somebody right. who can speak to it as opposed to it just being a bottle on a shelf.
It looks like the tour is coming out. Do you think this would be a good time for us to go in?
Sure.
Can we look at the machine a little bit?
Yeah,
and maybe
absolutely.
Do some tasting?
Perfect timing.
Hello.
Good. Hey.
Hey.
This is my sister.
Hi. Nicole.
Hi. I'm Abby.
Nice to meet you, Abby. I'm actually recording an interview with Phil right now for my podcast.
I won't interrupt.
Sorry. So tell me about this machine and where it comes from. I see this Italian flag on the side of it.
Yeah, it comes from Tuscany, a little family just south of Florence. This is the third one we've had. Dad started with a very little one in the beginning, then upgraded to a slightly bigger, and then had this one kind of custom built for us, which in the grand scheme of olive oil mills is still tiny. But for our purposes, this is large, significant. It makes about 250 gallons of olive oil a day.
Wow.
And, you know, this year we sold maybe 3,000 gallons of olive oil. So we only need to run this thing for a dozen or so days, 20 maybe. To get all of our season's oil.
That's great.
Step one is what they call the hopper, where you dump the olives in, and that mechanically cleans them, knocks off twigs, dirt, leaves, things like that. You don't want to wash them, because if you add water, it's harder to separate out the oil later on. Then they go up into the crusher, which is basically like a giant blender, just pulverizes them, pits and all, mashes the pits, scan everything up into a purple paste. Those two steps happen very quickly, just in a few seconds, and then it gets carried into what they call the malaxers or the mixers, which are just big mixing bowls, essentially, where there's a slow blade that turns around and slowly mixes it for about half an hour. And that allows the little droplets of oil that have been freed up from breaking open the fruit to coalesce, and the oil kind of separates itself out of the mixture a little bit and makes it easier to split in the next process, which is when that paste is then pumped into a large centrifuge or decanter, and that spins it out. And like any centrifuge, it separates things by density. And since the olive oil is the lightest component of the paste, the olive oil essentially comes off the top. And any water in the fruit, the skin, the fruit, the pit, all of that is heavier and gets sent out a different side of the centrifuge.
What do you do with the leftover paste?
So in big operations, they tend to take that paste and run it through a second processing. And that's where the term first press comes, because it has to be the first run. You can take that paste, run it through again, and usually they have to heat it up, and then you can force a little bit more oil out. In our case, we take that paste and we use it as compost and mulch.
Nice. Around the olive trees or in other parts of the farm?
Mostly around the olive trees, but a little bit everywhere. If you take some of that paste and mix it in with existing compost piles, and we'll take dirt from around the base of the healthiest, oldest olive trees. We'll take some olive leaves and little branches, and then a lot of native plants from around the property. Mix that with all kinds of other things, some of the aquatic plants from our ponds, for example. And you get a very rich compost that has all the microbial life of your native ecosystem, and especially the microbial life that lives in the soil at the base of the olive trees. And then after that's nice and mature, we take sections of that compost, put it into big, sort of giant cheesecloth type bags, dunk it in a big tub of water, and you bubble oxygen through it and add sugar to it. And the combination of the sugar and the oxygen causes the microbial life to multiply exponentially, and all the nutrients also just steep out into the liquid, so it's like a giant batch of tea. And then we can pump that tea through the irrigation lines to the entire grove.
Oh.
And it's literally a living fertilizer that you have to use within about 6 hours of making it. So it's not something you can buy or transport. You have to make it yourself, and it's free, and it's the single best fertilizer you can have.
Fabulous. Shall we do a little tasting?
Sure.
I like that the bottle and the label has remained essentially the same.
Yeah, that is our core look for sure. When we use the cobalt blue glass because it blocks as much light as possible.
Right.
Without being black glass, which would be kind of depressing.
A little, which might be off-putting. People like the bottles a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me what I'm looking at here. I need to put my indoor glasses on. Hold on a second.
So we've got, first up, the extra virgin olive oils, which we've broken down into mild, medium, and strong, or Provençal, Tuscan, and Andalusian. And it just so happens that pretty much all the French olives tend to be mild. All the Italians tend to be somewhere in the middle, more grassy and peppery. And all the Spanish tend to be the most strong and robust and sharp.
So in keeping with the cuisines, it makes sense.
Yeah, and that kind of gives people a progression, starting with the mildest, working their way up, and
right.
They can kind of feel out they like. Or like them all, depends on what you're cooking.
All right, let's start with the Provençal. I'm gonna give us a little bit, or you can pour, and then you show me how a professional olive oil taster tastes.
So we have bread out here, because a lot of people like to dip it in bread, but it's better just to take a sip of the olive oil straight. So there you go.
Super buttery, oh my goodness.
So yeah, that one's pretty mild. This is later in the season, of course.
Oh gosh,
it's already the end of August. If we were tasting in, say, March, these would all be sharper, stronger, because they'd just be very fresh.
Okay, so this is the Tuscan.
You can probably taste a little grassier.
I was going to say.
More of that like fresh-cut grass flavor.
Yeah.
That's very typical of Tuscan oils because they tend to harvest them early in the season to avoid the frost. Because in northern Italy, they'll get snow. So they pick them when they're still much greener, and you get that grassy flavor as a result.
But it's got that butteriness that kind of girds it.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
It's a bit more middle of the road. Now here comes the Andalusian.
Okay.
And this is mostly from our old grove trees.
Cheers.
Oh, okay. Should you start in any particular...
That one you can probably tell has a bit more of a bite to it.
Yeah, definitely. I want to say that there's like something nutty about it too.
Yeah. It's definitely stronger, more peppery, more earthy, more nutty.
Yeah.
And you can feel that bite in the back of your throat a bit more.
You can, but it's also like, it's sort of, but it's suffused by the same kind of buttery, you know, there's like a mellowness that offsets that as well.
Yeah, which is the core vibe of the olive oil, if you will.
Thank you. That was fun. So you also sell cosmetics made with olive oil. Are they made with your olive oil or olive?
Yes, all with our olive oil.
Okay.
So we've finally gotten to a point now where we have a little bit of olive oil left over at the end of the season. And we'll never sell last year's oil when we've got this year's oil.
Right.
So we take whatever is left and we use that to make our cosmetics. In our case, that oil is still food grade.
Oops, sorry.
So our cosmetics you could literally eat. which is helpful because you essentially are eating cosmetics in a way.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Especially something like lip balm, which is our most popular. You compare it to the ingredients of something like a chapstick, which is fairly toxic, and you're essentially eating that stick.
Got another thing I've never thought about.
Albeit slowly. Whereas our lip balm is 95% organic extra virgin olive oil.
Ah.
So you can give it to your kids and they can happily snack away on it, and you know it's healthy for them.
Up until this point, I haven't really brought in the culture piece of this episode, at least not explicitly. In a sense, it's baked in. As we discovered in the episode on culture, the meaning of the word culture goes back to agriculture, and the cultivation of olives is one of the oldest forms of farming we know. Moreover, it's impossible to overstate the cultural importance of olives and olive oil throughout the course of human history.
It was used as a currency. It was used to anoint kings. It was used as a means of war for, you know, lubricating horse saddles and weaponry, guns. It's a symbol of peace, a symbol of prosperity. It's all over religious texts. It's on the iconography of, you know, the United States, the United Nations. It's pretty much everywhere and throughout our history is either olive oil, olive leaves, olive branches.
I asked Phil if he sees himself as inheriting this rich history in some way. He seems drawn not to the glory of olive oil and its history, but rather to its elemental, earthborn properties.
It's a wonderfully healthy food that is very elemental. It's something very simple that anyone can see and understand. And it's something that everybody can use, you know, in their everyday cooking. Certainly as we move towards a healthier diet, people are using more olive oil as opposed to butter and other things like that. But it's really, I think, about maintaining our connection to our food and to our history.
Do you feel like your experience as an olive, I want to call you an olive oil farmer, even though that doesn't make much sense, has given you a different connection to the land as well?
Definitely. There's something very peaceful and satisfying about being tied to something that's in sync with the seasons, that's once a year, that has a ritual to it, a process, where every year, you know, you start with the pruning of the trees and then, you know, watching and protecting the blossoms and seeing them turn into little baby olives, then watching those get bigger, then protecting the olives to make sure they don't get damaged by heat or wind or things like that. And then deciding when to pick them. And then, of course, the milling, which is a huge undertaking, the harvesting and processing of all of it. And then being able to relax and pause for a moment, enjoy the holidays, and then start back over again with the pruning.
That cyclical relationship is really nice.
Yeah, very enjoyable.
Yeah. It's funny, I have an episode that I'm working on about the apocalypse. And as a narrative, one of the basic things about apocalypse, and there's a scholar who's written about the relationship between this and Western literature, is that it's a beginning and a story with a beginning and an end, you know, that it's almost kind of teleological in a sense that the end is presumed in the beginning. And ever since I thinking about that, I've thought about how much these ways of thinking about time really affect our relationship to the natural world. And I think, you know, a much older conception of time is a more cyclical one, because obviously as long as we've been farming, we've been connected to the seasons, and that's necessarily cyclical. And so it's interesting to hear you mention that and to think about, you know, just how that affects your relationship to place, you know, to your place in the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and gives you a much deeper concern and responsibility for maintaining that place, because you know that it's very important that everything works the way it does, that the bees are here, the bugs are here, the birds are here, yeah, that the water is here.
Right.
That all of these things come into play and you need them in order to grow food.
Right. And so maybe this is an appropriate place to talk about the fact that you don't just grow olive trees here. You have other things that you plant, and you've created this big collecting pool that is now a pond that has all this vibrant life in it. Can you describe that?
Sure.
A little bit?
So water is a huge element of the equation, of course, for all farmers, but particularly where we are in Southern California, because it's quite hot and quite dry here. Fortunately, olive trees don't need a lot of water, but they do need some. And we have good wells on the property, so we're fortunate to have our own groundwater. But we want to be responsible, so we've also built a series of interconnected ponds to collect rainwater and recharge our local aquifer, which at this point hold, I think, about 2 million gallons collectively between all the ponds, a little over a million in the main pond. And that acts as a way for us to maintain groundwater throughout the year, recharge the local aquifer, help support local insect and bird life, raises the humidity of our soil, raises the humidity of the air in our little microclimate. And it's a cumulative effect that it just gets better and better every year. The longer that water is there, the healthier the entire region gets. And over a long enough period of time, you'll be able to see basically the whole area below downstream from us getting greener and greener year by year. So that was a big project, but it's wonderful, and it also gives us a place to grow aquatic plants. We have 7 kinds of edible fish in the pond for people that want fish. We can source our own, you know, at home, which is really nice. And it gives us a source of water in case of things like fire.
Fire, needless to say, is an issue in Southern California. Earlier in our conversation, I asked Phil about a devastating fire that occurred in December of 2017.
It was called the Thomas Fire. At the time, it was the biggest fire in California's history. Until the following year, there was an even bigger one. But basically, what started as a small fire ultimately swept all around the entirety of the Ojai Valley, whole mountains surrounding it, like a big donut, and then started working its way down towards the valley floor. We're right on the fringe of the valley, kind of up in the foothills. Most of those regions burned. And it burned about, I would say, 10 acres of our farm. But once the fire got to the olive groves, it stopped dead in its tracks because olive trees don't really burn, which one would think is not the case. You think of it probably as an oily tree or an oily plant because of the olive oil, but they're very fire resistant. And we have a line of them that reaches across the entire border of our property that the fire came down. And it just stopped the thing dead in its tracks and pretty much saved the whole neighborhood.
Phil's experience during the Thomas Fire, incidentally, my brother was one of those people you see on TV who defies the evacuation order and goes back to save his property. It's crazy. Anyway, it motivated him to be better prepared next time.
When the fires came through here, the first thing it did was knock out all the power lines, which then knocked out all the water systems. With no power, you can't run pumps. So all the water and power was down in the neighborhood for 2 weeks. But if you have big ponds with 1 million gallons of water sitting right there, it's fairly easy to run a small generator and have a hose, and you can pump that water out and protect your house. So it serves many purposes and was just a really satisfying project to do.
That's terrific. Do you have any future projects to extend that or to sort of increase the biodiversity of the property?
Yes, so we're working with neighbors to help them construct some ponds in our larger neighborhood, if you will, to kind of keep that effect spreading out further. And then we're planting pretty much everything that can grow here, which in California is a lot. So we've got berry nurseries and herb nurseries and tea nurseries, all of our own vegetables, of course. We were just talking yesterday about putting in a tropical nursery so we can have our own bananas and pineapples. Bugs me having to buy bananas from Dole at the grocery store, so we want our own. And basically just try to get to a point where virtually 100% of our food comes from the property.
It's the real off-the-grid dream, huh?
Definitely. Yeah, your own water, your own power, your own food, your own shelter.
If you're ever in Ojai, you can stop by the Olive Barn yourselves and sample the different oils. It's a special place. For more information, go to their website, ojaioliveoil.com. Also check out the pictures on my website, in-the-weeds.net. Thanks for listening. To support this podcast, please leave me a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell a friend. Thanks.